anyone here for the second case, feel free to step forward. We actually, I guess y'all are the third case, but the second case rescheduled. So it's William Richardson versus the State of Texas.
William Richardson. This case, what it really boils down to is an individual who associated with the wrong people and who was unfairly prosecuted by the state, and who was prosecuted to such an extent that his sentence is the highest sentence that I have ever found for the offense that he was charged with. It's the highest sentence in the nation. It's the highest sentence in the state and in federal courts. The three issues that I'm going to focus on are three of the four issues that I raised in my brief. The first one is that the trial court improperly allowed the accomplice testimony of Kelly Wood. The second is that even with Ms. Wood's testimony, there was insufficient evidence to find Mr. Richardson guilty of possessing the fraudulent information that the state claimed that he had. And finally, as I stated a moment ago, the sentence that Mr. Richardson received was disproportionate to the offense that he actually committed. This case started when my client, Mr. Richardson, was pulled over for driving his mother's car with his bright lights on, something that I'm sure everyone has done at some point. When he was pulled over, he cooperated with the police. He said, "This is my mother's car." He gave him his driver's license, and the police officer went back and checked his records to see if there was an open warrant. Indeed, there was an open warrant for Mr. Richardson. After it was determined there was an open warrant, Mr. Richardson would ask if he would give consent to search the car. Mr. Richardson agreed to give consent to search the car. The car was searched, and in the back seat, in a red folder that was closed, was found a list of 57 names and credit card information. Inside that folder was the passenger's information, who was Mr. Gary Webster. And as the record reflects, Mr. Webster was the key to this whole thing. He was the mastermind behind this whole scheme, using other people's information to obtain items and obtain money. Also in the car was a computer registered to Mr. Webster that had ways to make fraudulent documents. The only thing that we have connecting my client at the stop to anything relating that in that red folder were two receipts, which I'm sure the state will talk about, and a business card for the Sun Shop. And the Sun Shop tanning is where this list of names came from. And we'll find out that Ms. Webster, the person who was seated in the passenger seat, was actually dating the lady who stole the list. And she's the accomplice whose testimony I believe should have been stricken.
What about the Visa card, the Unicard, the Human Services card of Virgie Davis, which I understood was in the driver's seat? That you're driving around with somebody else's ID?
Miss Virgie Davis was not one of the 57 people named in the red folder. She was not one of the people alleged in the indictment, and her information was not one of the acts that the state alleged my client of committing. If all the state would have alleged that my client did was have her information, or his information, I'm sorry, the crime, first of all, would have been a state jail felony for having one piece, not over 50. And the Virgie Davis connection has no connection to what ultimately my client was convicted of. My client was ultimately convicted of possessing the 57 names, not Virgie Davis's names. He wasn't even charged with that, as far as I'm aware. In fact, the state's case really hinged on the testimony of Kelly Wood. A little bit about Kelly Wood. Kelly Wood was a meth addict. She testified as such. She worked at the Sun Shop Tanning Salon. And while she worked there, she stole, and she admitted that she stole, 57 names, a list of credit card information. She testified that when she came to the house, she gave it to Gary Webster. Her testimony is somewhat conflicted as to whether my client was present at the time or not, but her testimony, not only is it inherently unreliable, as the Texas jurisprudence states, that an accomplice's testimony should be looked at very skeptically, it can't be corroborated by any other person, by any other testimony that they had. A couple of the facts that Ms. Kelly Wood testified to that no one else testified to was that appellant lived with Gary Webster, that that's where his residence was. In fact, there are court documents that suggest his residence was somewhere else. Second, appellant was present when Wood brought the Sunshop list to Webster. She's the only one who testified that, and she contradicted herself on that point.
Why couldn't Webster testify that they were roommates? Her testimony could not be corroborated by anybody else. How about by Mr. Webster?
It could have been corroborated by Mr. Webster, but it was not. In fact, Mr. Webster was not called because he was charged.
You said couldn't. And
I'm sorry, shouldn't. Or was not. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm with you.
She was also the only person who testified that Mr. Richardson was Mr. Webster's driver, that he drove him around. She was also the only person who testified that my client used any of the information regarding the Sunshop Tanning Salon that she had stolen. And she was also the only one who could testify about how the fraudulent scheme worked, about how they got this information and what they did with it. There was speculative testimony by the police officers about how it possibly could have occurred, but she was the only one who gave true insight into what happened. It was not corroborated by anyone else. In Texas, a defendant cannot be convicted based on accomplice testimony alone. And as I said earlier, the courts have noted that it's an accomplice's testimony is highly speculative, especially in this case. Ms. Wood testified on the stand, and the state will agree, that she took a plea of only 80 days in jail and deferred adjudication for stealing the 57 items for which my client got life. And she also had cases in Denton County. She had cases in Dallas County. She had cases everywhere for this same offense, for stealing and using. So she had a reason to be making these things up. In cases where there was sufficient corroborating evidence, you have things like the items were found at the individual's home. Some were found on his person, and then when they did a search warrant on his home, they were also found at his home. You have another one where it was actually in the individual's wallet. In other words, a fake ID was found in the individual's wallet on his person. In this case, it was found in the back seat of the car in a red folder that was closed.
The car that he was driving and in possession of.
Yes, he was driving the car, okay. but the question becomes, and I'll get to that in a moment when I go to the sufficiency of whether he possessed it, is whether or not a driver has to be responsible for everything that's in the car that an individual brings into the car. And I certainly don't want to be responsible for everything that someone brings into my car. And
well, did you have testimony that someone brought it into the car?
Well,
he was driving the car. It was his mom's car, and it's in the car. Now, I think there's obviously a presumption of possession. I mean, did someone testify that Mr. Webster put it in the car?
Well, the police testified that the only things in that red folder all belonged to Mr. Webster, that there was nothing that belonged to my client in that red folder, which is where the conviction stems.
Okay. What, by the way, since we're complaining about the length of our sentence, what's happened to Mr. Webster, who you obviously are pointing to be as the main culprit here?
That I do not know. I do not have that.
It would be a good comparison from sentences if we knew what had happened to Mr. Webster, the main guy, as you point out, vis-a-vis your client.
I'm sure the state will let us know that.
All right.
As far as the possession, this case presents a novel issue that really hasn't been decided yet. It's how do we determine affirmative links, or do we use the affirmative links test on a possession of fraudulent materials case? That has never been decided before. I have suggested, and I believe the state agree with me, that some variation of the affirmative links test should be used in this case where it's alleged that two or more people are possessing an item in a vehicle as to whether or not it actually was possessed. And some of those links, which have been used in the past on drug cases, are things like...
Two or more people in a vehicle are possessing an item, it wasn't possessed. Go through that again, please. What did you say?
Possession is defined as actual care, custody, and control or management. In the Texas law, what Texas has said is that if the state alleges that two or more people are possessing something that's not in any one person's control, in other words, it's not in one person's possession, that we use an affirmative links test. And what that is it's a list of factors. And, in fact, it changes from case to case. If you read various cases, some have certain factors, some have others. That particular test has not been used in a possession of fraudulent materials case up until now. But I believe, because it's all the possession is defined by the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, that it will be the same test that will be applied here. Some of those things include what happened when the defendant was asked about the items. And in this case, the police come up and say, "Can I search the car?" And he says, "Sure." They ask, "Do you have any items in here that are contraband?" He says, "No." That shows that he was not aware of the fact that that red folder was in the back. The other things he talks about were where the contraband was found. The thing that he was charged with having was found in the back seat of the car, not in the front seat, not where he could reach it, but in the back seat of the car directly behind the passenger. And the passenger, as we stated once again, was Mr. Webster. The second, one of the other issues is whether there was a significant amount of contraband. In this case, there was one list in a red folder in the back seat of the car. It was 14 pages inside the folder and closed. Appellant does not believe that under any of the tests, the state can show that he actually possessed those items, and believes that he should be acquitted of this case. Finally, the final issue I'd like to talk about is whether his offense was disproportionate, or his sentence was disproportionate to the offense committed. Under Solem versus Helm, which is the seminal case, the test decided is, number one, the gravity of the offense and the harshness of the punishment. So in other words, you compare the gravity of the offense versus the amount of punishment. Number two is the sentence imposed on other people in the same jurisdiction. And number three is the sentence imposed for the same offense in other jurisdictions. And in this case, my client was charged with possessing over 50 items, over 50 fraudulent items, which is a first-degree felony. However, and there were 57 names on the list. However, he received the maximum punishment for this range. When you compare what he did versus the sentence that he got, which is what we're asked to do under the first step, I think you'll find that they don't match up. First, the offense that he committed was passive in nature. He didn't harm anyone. He didn't murder. He didn't take a gun. He didn't physically assault anyone. Second, the first degree range starts at 50. Even if we agree that he possessed it, he only had 57, and he got life, which was the maximum sentence under this.
Of course, now this wasn't his first rodeo.
No, it was not. It was not, but it was his first.
That kind of has something to do with taking into account what you're going to get.
And I agree with that. But it was his first possession of fraudulent material or any type of fraud. As far as I know, he was convicted of burglary. And I believe robbery.
Well, I know, but if he had a history of fraud and he murdered somebody, would you back here say, yes, but it's his first murder?
Well, Your Honor, the way I look at the disproportionate test, and I know the courts have struggled with the whether you take into account the
history.
The history.
Right.
The way I look at it is, the first thing that you have to determine is whether what he did justifies the sentence, whether what he did on this occasion justifies the sentence. And then you look at, you know, what type of sentence should he receive?
But the answer to the first question is going to be no without the history. I would think that you can't sentence somebody to life in prison just based on fraud. It's because of he has his history that bumps up the punishment range, I would think.
Well, it actually is a first-degree felony to possess the 50 by itself. And I believe that that is the reason that he was sentenced as harshly as he was, in connection with the fact that he did have a prior. In conclusion, we believe that that was grossly disproportionate, his life sentence, and we would ask to for a new trial regarding punishment.
Thank you. Mr. Orbison?
May it please the court. I'm Charles Orbison, representing the state in this case. In the first issue that deals with insufficient corroboration of the accomplice testimony of Kelly Wood, the state believes there was a multitude of evidence that corroborated the testimony of Kelly Wood and has outlined it fairly extensively in the brief that you have before you. There's no dispute, of course, that Kelly Wood was an accomplice as a matter of law. And the jury was instructed about that, was told what an accomplice was told that Kelly Wood was accomplice, and was told that it couldn't consider any of her testimony unless there, or couldn't convict, rather, unless there was other evidence exclusive of the testimony of Kelly Wood that tended to connect appellant to the offense. Now, as I was hearing opposing counsel talk, it seemed to me he was confusing the corroboration law. The corroborative evidence does not have to corroborate every aspect of the accomplice's testimony, and so that, sure, there were things that only she testified about. All of those things did not have to be corroborated. What corroboration means that there has to be sufficient evidence that tends to connect the appellant with the offense, exclusive of the testimony of the accomplice. And clearly we had that in this case. I could go through all that evidence. I don't really need to take the court's time to do that. It's in the brief. But as Justice McCoy pointed out, there was evidence in the seat. He was the driver. There was evidence in his wallet that connected him to the actual lists that opposing counsel was talking about. I would like to clear up a couple of things. First of all, we cannot minimize all the other evidence that was in that car that showed a much larger identity theft scam that was being perpetrated not only by Mr. Webster, but also by appellant.
And speaking of Mr. Webster.
Sir. I'm sorry.
What has happened to Mr. Webster?
He was convicted.
And what sentence did he get?
You know, I did that appeal, and this court just handed down the opinion last week. His conviction was affirmed, and I was sitting there trying to think. It was not life. It was either 60 or 70 years, I believe, is what he got. I'm pretty sure it's one of those two. He was quite a bit older than Mr. Richardson, so a 60 or 70-year sentence at his age would mean something more, would be that approaching a life sentence. It was a very severe sentence
now,
that he received.
Was the sentence for this crime without any history life, was that an available sentence?
It was, Your Honor. It was a first.
With no history, he could have been
sentenced. Without any history whatsoever, the range was 5 to 99 or life. With the history, under the habitual offender statute, the sentence was 15 to 99 or life. It changed the minimum from 5 to 15. Certainly, the jury took his criminal history into account. I know we're jumping ahead to issue 4, but certainly the jury took his criminal history into account when they awarded a life sentence. The one that we enhanced with 2, but abandoned 1. The one that survived and that he was actually enhanced with under 1242 was aggravated assault of a police officer with a deadly weapon. Pretty bad offense. He stipulated at trial that he also had 3 DWIs, the last one being a felony. We all know that DWI is a very dangerous offense. He may not be a per se violent offense, but it's a dangerous offense. It's a grave offense. Aggravated assault of a police officer with a gun is a grave offense. Identity theft at the level approaching in this case is a very grave offense. None of us are immune to all of the information out there about how identity theft can actually wreck people's lives for extended periods of time. All of the cases that Mr. Wilson cited and the disproportionality analysis, I went through every one. Almost all of them, the defendant had one piece of identified information. We can't use those cases to compare the sentences. Here, there were 57 alleged. Now, in that red folder, there were more than 400 names with Social Security, I mean, not Social Security, credit card information and expiration dates. The state needed to allege 50 or more in order to get it to a first-degree offense. We could have alleged 400 just in that red folder. And there was so much more that was not in the red folder, in the gray plastic box in the front seat, on the computer, which was admittedly Mr. Webster's computer. But there, Richardson was a party to all of this identity theft scam. There were names, there was information scattered throughout that car. Cards, fraudulent cards. You simply can't say 57 names is all there was, because there was so much more. And even without the testimony of Kelly Wood, he was tied, the appellant was tied to that information. Clearly, it would have been irrational for the jury to have concluded he wasn't aware of that information. They had a mobile fraudulent card shop in that car with a computer hooked to a photo quality printer, which was hooked to the cigarette lighter. It would have been impossible to have been in that car and not know what was going on. And it's sheer speculation on Mr. Wilson's part to say that the red folder that had the 57 names was not accessible to the driver, right behind the driver's seat. To me, more accessible to the driver than to the passenger. It just doesn't make any sense to say that it wasn't. The evidence, as we look at the sufficiency of the evidence, then of course we include the testimony of Kelly Wood, which made it very clear of appellant's involvement in the, not only in the 57 names, but the entire identity theft scam that was being perpetrated. Under the cruel and unusual punishment, I just want to make a couple of points. Oh, by the way, I was going to say one thing. I'm not sure where Mr. Wilson got the factor. I don't disagree that we could use the controlled substance factors, because there's not a case that I could find where possession of the identifying information was challenged in a sufficiency challenge in a fraudulent possession of identifying information case. So without that out there, it kind of makes sense to me also maybe to use the controlled substance factors. I'm not going to disagree with that. There are some factors, as the state points out in its brief, do not apply. But other than that, I think the same kind of analysis makes sense. I've never seen the factor, what happened when the accused was asked about the item that counselor was telling you about. That would be a nice factor for him, because, of course, he denied it at the scene. But I don't ever recall seeing that factor in any of the cases concerning controlled substance. Courts, if I could disagree with the opposing counsel on another point, courts have not struggled with applying the disproportionality analysis to criminal history. It is clear they do. There's no struggle there. Courts clearly say, when we're looking at how severe the sentence was in reference to the offense, not only do we look at the offense itself, but we look at what else this guy has done, because that surely goes into the jury's consideration of a sentence. There has been no struggle there. That is clearly the law in the state's opinion. It certainly wasn't his first rodeo. The only last point I would make about the cruel and unusual punishment is that we do not use the three solem factors. I think that's been pretty clearly established as well. We don't use the second two unless the court, the reviewing court, in examining the first one, determines that the sentence was grossly disproportionate to the gravity of the offense. There are dozens of cases that hold that. I don't think there's any dispute on that. Here, there certainly isn't any type of gross disproportionality. It's a grave offense. We all know it's a grave offense. This was the highest level that could have been committed. Yes, we alleged 57 names. To get to the highest level, we could have alleged many, 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 many more. This was the worst kind of possession of identifying information case you can have. In addition to that, the man had a very dangerous criminal history and had a prior conviction for a grave offense of aggravated assault of a peace officer and dangerous activity and with his DWIs. If the court doesn't have any question, I think that I will end there and just pray that this court affirm this conviction. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Just to clear up, on the affirmative links test that I cited to in my brief, one of the issues is whether the defendant made incriminating statements when he was arrested. That's Jones versus State out of Texarkana, and it's also cited by the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in 2008. As far as...
What was the question? I've forgotten exactly what the question was. You said he answered...
It's one of the links that shows possession.
What's the question?
And the question that he was asked was, you know, it's a standard police question, do you have anything illegal in the car? And his answer was no. And another one of the factors is, did he make any furtive movements? In other words, when the police pulled up behind him, did he try to shove something in the back seat that would show that he actually had the possession of the red? And he didn't do that either.
Well, I guess, though, if he had answered, yes, I have this thing in the car, and it's illegal, we wouldn't need to go to the list, would we?
Well, we would need to go to the list, but we probably wouldn't be here because there probably would have been a plea. But
okay.
As far as the disproportionate, counsel is correct, and if there was any confusion about that, I apologize. The threshold issue is whether there's a discrepancy between the offense and the sentence. And the way I look at that is, you know, if someone is in, if you hear that someone got X amount of time for committing X offense, are you kind of like, wow, I can't believe that that sentence was that high? And in this case, I believe that we meet that first step. I believe that you hear he got life for simply possessing some credit card information. That, to me, rises above the first step. Now, that doesn't mean that we win that issue. What it means is the court has to go through and then address the second two issues. And in the second two issues, the first thing we need to remember is that one of the accomplices, her punishment for stealing the actual list was 80 days in jail and deferred adjudication. And if you go through the Texas cases, and I admit that I couldn't find any other first-degree cases like this, but you'll look and you'll see what other people got for possessing fraudulent information.
But where does the history factor into this? I mean, there's a difference between this was the first time that he'd ever been arrested since he was a Cub Scout, and he does this versus his history, including one pretty darn serious offense.
And I believe it comes into your analysis, but I believe it comes after the threshold step.
All right, so you're saying it's in two or three?
Well,
really doesn't make any sense. I mean, if this was his 18th credit card scam arrest, and you heard, oh,
he got life for a credit card scam? That's shocking. Well, it's not shocking if you knew it was his 18th one. I mean, doesn't it make sense to you that the history plays a part in factor uno?
I will leave that to you, Your Honor.
Okay.
As far as the final thing I want to say is that even under the federal laws, my client could have only been sentenced, the sentencing guidelines are 10 to 15 years for doing exactly what he did. And with all that in mind, Your Honor, I would ask that this court reverse and remand or reverse and acquit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Orbison. We appreciate you all being here today. Thank you for your arguments. You are dismissed. The clerk will adjourn us.
All rise. The honorable court is adjourned.